Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. Today's show is all about wrongful convictions. In the last month, the Netflix show Making a Murderer has taken up the mantle of the podcast Serial and explored whether a man accused of murder was actually innocent. The case of Stephen Avery is now being retried in the court of public opinion and raising some concerns about the criminal justice system. We'll probably make plenty of references to the show today. If you haven't watched that yet, this is your one and only spoiler alert. My co-host today is Sarah Mervosh.
Hey, Jen.
Hello. I used to cover courts and have written quite a bit about wrongful convictions and the reason behind them, and Sarah covers courts now. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will end the show with his latest Hashing It Out segment about the latest developments in the corruption case against Dallas County Commissioner John Wiley Price. But first, joining us in the studio today are Christopher Scott.
Thanks for having me.
And Patricia Cummings.
Happy to be here.
Patricia is an assistant district attorney in Dallas County. She oversees the Conviction Integrity Unit, which looks into possible wrongful convictions. Chris, our first guest to make a return appearance, was in prison for a dozen years for a murder he didn't commit. He now runs the nonprofit House of Renewed Hope and investigates other wrongful convictions. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Let's talk a little bit about how wrongful convictions happen. What goes wrong?
I'll start with that, and I tell you, it's a complicated question because there's lots of different things that go wrong in cases where we have been able to establish that a person was wrongfully convicted because they were factually innocent. So although I say there's lots of them, probably the ones you're going to hear the most about are going to be eyewitness identifications that are faulty. In addition to that, you do see cases involving false confessions. Another big category where we see a lot of correlation is if there has been false or misleading forensic science. And then finally, probably one of the more controversial topics is when you have official misconduct, whether that be on the part of the police department or the prosecutor, but essentially you have something going wrong ethically that shouldn't have happened.
And Patricia, something that we should probably clear up right up front is, what is the difference between being wrongfully convicted and being actually innocent?
Believe it or not, that seems like a very simple question, but I think it's a controversial question as well. And the reason is, depending on who you're asking for that definition, they may come up with a different answer. Probably the starting point for most people is to look at the National Registration of Exonerees, and they will actually have a definition of exoneration, and they've got it on their website in two different respects. They have the short version, and then they have the long version. But essentially, what they are saying is that you have an exoneration, which obviously could only come as a result of wrongful convictions, where ultimately, after the wrongful conviction, the charge is dropped based on some newly discovered evidence. In Texas, I think we look at it a little different, at least from my perspective, from the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, because you can have a situation where somebody was wrongfully convicted. In other words, there might have been a due process problem. So we say they didn't get a fair trial, but that doesn't mean that you're going as far as to say that the person is factually innocent of the crime. So in Texas, we tend to look at it a little different, but obviously wrongful conviction that results in an actual innocence finding leads to the exoneration, but you can have somebody wrongfully convicted without the newly discovered evidence who ultimately doesn't get tried again, and so they end up not having that conviction on their record.
Chris, can you tell us a little bit about your case and what you see now went wrong?
For starters, pretty much it was the tunnel vision that everybody had towards my case, because even though we had evidence to prove that we couldn't have been the two individuals that committed this crime or was nowhere around the scene of the crime, I didn't know anything about it. And to see how they were just focused on me and Claude Simmons, when you had people coming to court, cops saying that they feel like they had the wrong two guys, here are the two guys that we think or know that committed this crime. And, you know, when you have two people pointed out and you just go get two individuals off the street and just haul them to jail and be like, hey, you're going to go to prison for this case, we're going to try you and sentence you and things of that nature, and tunnel vision is a major aspect in our criminal court systems right now.
And Chris, our listeners may not be familiar with the facts of your situation. So can you tell them just briefly, you know, what happened, who was the victim in your case, and what happened?
Alfonso Aguilar was the victim in this case. He was a drug seller in a pretty middle-class neighborhood. And my co-defendant, Claude Simmons, lived in this neighborhood. And I went to pick up Claude one night, and the murder happened maybe 3-4 hours before I even got to the neighborhood. So when I picked Claude up, and we rode around the neighborhood maybe a couple of times and stopped at 7-Eleven, the kid at Dr. Pepper. And on the way back, an officer passed us by, and she did a U-turn and followed us to Claude Simmons' house. We went inside of his house. They called the phone, told us to come out. We came outside. It was like 10 of us laying in the on the ground. And it was crazy because I was like the one in the middle. And I know everybody heard the phrase, like, pick the one in the middle. And that seemed like that was the objective. They got me out, picked me up off the ground. And what was crazy about it, everybody on the right side of me actually was part of this crime. But I'm sitting right in the middle of all of these individuals. Put me in a police car. They say, well, some lady's going to come identify you. If she can't, we have to let you go. But maybe 10 minutes later, they say, no, she's not coming here. We're going to take you to the Capers Building, Crimes Against Persons, and she'll identify you there. So, okay. But I know she wasn't going to identify me because I know whatever they charged me with or questioned me about, I didn't do it. So they put me in front of a big glass door where, you know, me, I can see everybody walk up and they can see me also. And they handcuffed me to a bench. And the cop walked the lady right up to me and say, this is the guy that killed your husband. And she said, yes, there's him. It wasn't a question. It was a statement. And I can understand if it was a question, it would have been maybe a different outcome or whatever the case may be. But it was a statement like, this is the guy. And from that day right there, I was tried and convicted to capital murder.
In addition to your case being about tunnel vision, it's also witness identification. Mm-hmm. And what was done to you is called a show up, where mm-hmm. the cops show up with a person and either say, this is the guy, is what happened in your case, or is this the guy? And there's no comparison. It's really frowned upon. And Dallas police in recent years, they have quit doing it. And mm-hmm. a lot of police departments have quit doing it, but not all have. It still happens today.
Yeah, I was just in a trial this week where they were sort of explaining the photo lineup situation. So it was a DPD case, and they used to just do like a panel of 6 people and they choose between them. But now they actually do where they have each person individually and they have to get an answer, yes, no, or not sure about whether that person was involved in the case before they can move on to the next person. So I think people, you know, there are changes that are being made to try to avoid these eyewitness testimony issues. But of course, like you said, it's still a problem.
And in addition to showing them subsequently, the photos are supposed to be shown by a detective who does not know who the suspect is.
Yeah, double blind.
The double blind.
Right.
I think it's important to add to the conversation that when you're talking about eyewitness identification, you kind of have two problems going on at the same time. One is the process of how law enforcement actually carries it out, but the other is just understanding kind of psychology and neuroscience in terms of whether or not a person who has just suffered some traumatic experience can actually properly identify the perpetrator. And there's a whole lot of research that's been done on that. And I think at the end of the day, you can't really come to an understanding and a correct way of dealing with it without looking at both aspects.
I think there's an idea that our memories are like a photograph or a video that we can look back on, and that has been proven scientifically that that is not the case, that we can't remember, you know, very well what the person's face looked like, let alone were they wearing a red shirt or a green shirt. And if you know, had someone come in this room and then leave, we would probably all have a different recollection of what that individual looked like. And none of us would ultimately be that reliable.
And another thing you and I have talked about, Patricia, is the issue of junk science. And we did have someone recently here in Dallas County who he's released for to have a new trial. Is that correct? On a bite mark case?
That's correct.
So what are some issues? What is junk science and how do they play out in wrongful convictions?
So some people refer to it as junk science. I just think that's the easy way I think the public has come to understand the concept. And the concept is this, that we have a long history in our criminal justice system of using science to help us arrive at the truth. And depending on...
DNA would be an example now.
Absolutely. And in the case that you talked about, bite marks, you have all different fields of science, and probably the best explanation is human nature is if we are a fact finder making a decision about whether or not somebody committed a crime, we just necessarily elevate the weight of the evidence when we're hearing from a scientist, whether it be a medical doctor or a psychologist, what have you, a forensic odontologist. We just naturally want to believe that they're in a better position to make the assessment. So, as I said, we afford more weight to it. Now, of course, like everything else in life, we realize as time goes by that we have advances in science. And so what we thought was really reliable at one point may not be 15 or 20 years later. And so starting back or circling back to the question of junk science, I think is just a recognition of that evolution. And I think it's an ability to go back and say, we're not afraid to look to see if a conviction was based on something that we now see as faulty or junk science.
So we've talked about junk science and eyewitness identification, but I want to get back to the tunnel vision issue, because in Making a Murderer, the sheriff's department mostly went after Stephen Avery. That's at least how the documentary portrays it. Had tunnel vision that he was the guy who committed this murder. But how often? And that seems like a pretty extreme case, Patricia. In your experience, how does the Making a Murderer situation compare to other possible wrongful convictions? And how do you actually investigate to tell whether a case is valid, worth looking into?
Multiple parts to that question. Let me start with just first addressing an issue about Making a Murderer that I think is necessary just as far as kind of truth in discussion. And that is, I think we're all coming to learn that there's some questions in the way that that documentary was made. Although I'll be the first to say that I think any lawyer ought to watch it. I also recognize that we've got to scrutinize it in the sense of, was it really true journalism in the sense that we were getting kind of a fair assessment of what went on in that case. As I said, the more I learn now, I kind of question whether or not we were in fact doing that, which kind of leads into the tunnel vision issue. Tunnel vision is an interesting concept. I think most people refer to it as Christopher has. The more scientific term for it is cognitive bias, and that is that just natural human processing is we tend to seek out what we already believe. And I think you got kind of two levels of that going on in Making a Murderer. I think you have that potentially going on in terms of how everybody from law enforcement to the prosecutor to the community looked at Stephen Avery and said, oh, this is a guy with a violent past, so he probably did it. But then I think you've also got it somewhat in the journalist perspective in terms of how the story was told. I do think, as I analyze it more in retrospect, that the folks that made the documentary, they kind of did the opposite. We're so used to thinking of tunnel vision in terms of this person is guilty, and so therefore I'm going to look at everything that proves it. Whereas I think what they were doing is they made the assessment, and maybe it was indeed through tunnel vision, but they made the assessment that he was being wrongfully targeted, wrongfully charged, and he was innocent, and they made the documentary that way.
I'm having a big problem with Making a Murderer. I haven't finished it because of the problems that you mentioned. They left out so many pieces of evidence that connect to his guilt. And, you know, if this was a trial, any good defense attorney would throw that out there and have an explanation for it. You know, there's so much going on with these police officers. There could be the argument made they planted it. You know, this, they could have all these arguments, but they just left it out. And as a journalist, it's who makes every effort to see both sides or all sides, it's really bothering me, especially because I know so many guys like Christopher who were wrongfully convicted. And when all the evidence is really thrown out there, you have to look at everything and how hard it is to prove a wrongful conviction. It really bothers me, and I'm going to finish it because I feel like I owe it to being interested in wrongful convictions and the reasons for it. But it's really painful for me to watch.
I wholeheartedly believe that you should finish it. I think that anybody who is interested in this topic needs to watch it. And I think it's a necessary conversation that we should be having when we look at what are the strengths and weaknesses of the criminal justice system. And I have to say, my investigator in the Conviction Integrity Unit, Jim Hammond, always talks about noble cause corruption. And noble cause corruption is essentially getting to a place where you say the ends justify the means. And what we've been doing, I think, as a society, at least in the last decade, is we're looking at that in terms of how do wrongful convictions occur, i.e. the tunnel vision. If we think our cause is right, then we are going to say the ends justify the means if we get the conviction. I think what making a murderer is the first time we've seen that turned on its head, where we also understand that the defense perspective could be as equally biased. If we go into something saying we think the system is so bad and that you've got an innocent person, I mean, you could be just as guilty as the people you're criticizing in regard to how wrongful convictions take place.
And one thing that Making a Murderer and actually Serial, the podcast, brought up for me was this idea of beyond a reasonable doubt, because I agree with all of you in that, you know, there were some issues in Making a Murderer journalistically, the way they presented it, and even in both cases, and we don't need to get into all the details of Serial, but I mean, both cases, there are clearly some issues and doubts that are raised. And in the case of Brendan Dassey, who appears to have had a forced confession, you know, that raises the question of why do people wrongfully confess if they didn't do it? And then also just, you know, this idea of beyond a reasonable doubt, that is the threshold from the jury. And as a viewer, I have reasonable doubt, and yet there's convictions in both cases.
So I think what people have to absolutely force themselves to do is to understand proving something beyond a reasonable doubt is not the equivalent of proving that somebody is actually innocent. And I hope I get the quote right, but one thing that just drove me crazy about a segment of Making a Murderer is when the prosecutor was talking about reasonable doubt only belongs to the innocent. And that just kind of advances the lack of understanding between the two fundamental concepts, because they are so incredibly different. And certainly, I think that you can watch Making a Murderer and you could walk away from it saying, you know, I had some doubt about whether or not Stephen Avery, and certainly whether or not Brendan Dassey, committed the crime, but that is so far removed from whether or not you actually believe they're both legally and factually innocent of the crime.
Chris, tell us a little bit about what it is like to be wrongfully convicted. You have had your trial, and you thought, just like you thought there was no way that woman was going to pick you because you didn't do it, mm-hmm. You thought, there's no way I'm going to prison because I didn't do it. And then you find yourself in prison. How do you get through the days? And how do you not just get so angry at the whole system, at the people who sent you there? And there probably had to be that, you know, anger initially, but, you know, getting to know you, you're not an angry guy. You are, you smile and you laugh all the time, and we have these great conversations. And how are you this remarkable person?
That's one of the first things that you have to get over. You have to get over the madness. You have to get over the bitterness, but because it's not going to give you the room that you need to think clearly. Being mad and bitter all the time, that only leads to a bitter and mad life. And being in prison, once you get there, it's about survival. Now, how am I going to be able to survive prison being mad and bitter all the time? So I have to make do what I have to make do until things could get better for me. And that was, you had to get I got a system down. You know, like I said, when I first went to prison, I was 135 pounds. And now I'm like 215. And when I left prison, I was bigger than that. I was like 225. So the first thing I had to do, I said, I'm around guys that's much larger and bigger than me. So I have to go to the gym, work out. And another thing, I have to put myself in a position where I can eat and keep that balanced meal and that good diet going on to make myself gain weight. And I got a job. That was step one, was working out. Step two was getting a job to pretty much compensate all the loose time I would have had to get in trouble in prison. I can work and do things and be more, you know, positive in prison by being a positive inmate. And after that, I started reading a lot of books. I read like 3 books per week. I was a big book reader. I read like 3 books per week because in prison, you're going to do a lot of reading. If that's being legal work or just reading novels to get you through the day. And at the end of the day, my favorite thing was the soap opera. I love, you know, General Hospital. And it's like I initiated that system into that, you know, 12 and a half years, and it kept me out of trouble. And being in a position where I got a capital murder case for something I didn't do, but I'm housed with inmates that's guilty and have just as much time that I have. So it's like a balance you have to do because these guys did it, you didn't do it. But if you end up getting in trouble and hurting somebody or killing somebody, me having a capital murder case, I automatically go to death row. And I was like, I can't put myself in a position like that because how would I ever get back to the kids I left that were still young, 5 and 6, when I, you know, came to prison? So once that bitter wiped away, I started just writing innocence projects of, you know, of all kinds. And that format that I had implemented in my day-to-day operations, it was still there. But it was now to get focused on trying to get myself freed out of prison. And dealing with that is crazy because you see so many wicked things in prison that you would never think that you would see. And it's hard for a person to go to prison and never being in that type of environment and to survive, you know, really in prison by any means necessary is the way you have to go by it if you want to survive.
And I think we hear from a lot of people in prison, you know, as journalists, we get letters. Patricia, I know you get dozens of letters from inmates who say that they are innocent. And obviously there are some that are truly are innocent. How do you determine which cases are worth looking at? And I'm sure, Chris, you also saw people with you who said they were innocent, but you knew truly you were innocent. So I'm just interested to figure out where do you put your resources? How do you determine what to focus on?
It's really difficult, and we receive hundreds of requests. And I wish I could tell you that there is some mathematical formula to figuring it out. And I think that there's probably people out there that think there's a mathematical formula, but there's not. And I guess I'm going to steal from Corey Sessions when he talks about this, because he basically says a lot of it is you've just got to stop yourself and you've got to figure out how you reevaluate a situation. So his example is, so you smell it instead of just looking at it. You listen to it. You use your senses to try to figure out, does something not seem right? And fortunately for me, I think I learned a lot about using those other senses because I was a criminal defense lawyer for over 20 years. And so my job was trying to look outside the box and don't go into a situation presuming that somebody's guilty. Instead, it was the opposite.
Well, and Patricia, you worked on the Michael Morton case, which is possibly one of Texas's most famous exonerees. What about that case made you realize that he was worth taking a look at?
It's interesting. Christopher was in my office the other day, and we were doing a training on various discovery, Brady issues, and wrongful convictions. And I was telling a story about my involvement on that case. And I actually started working on Michael's case in 2004. And so that was long before the DNA fight. And I will never forget the first day that I actually went down into the basement of the district clerk's office in Williamson County and actually got to see the physical evidence. And one of the very first pieces of evidence I saw was the famous note that Michael had left his wife. And I pull it out, and I'm actually getting, I shouldn't be saying this, but we're getting to touch it and read it and see it. And I read that, and I had some background information on the case, but once I read that, something went off in my mind saying, he didn't do it.
And why did you think that?
It just, you know, the idea that note constituted motive for him to commit the crime just was nonsensical to me.
And the note, it was something about one of their birthdays, and
it was Michael's birthday the night before, and they had gone out for a very nice dinner with their son. And when they got home, he had expectations for the way the rest of the night would go, and it didn't pan out. And he left a note just simply telling his wife how he felt about that. And he specifically said, I don't want to get in a fight about it, but I just want you to know how I feel. And so I looked at it and I'm like, okay, so if I think that that is proof that he committed his crime, it's kind of hard to articulate, but you've got to at the same time think he's the smartest person on the planet and also the dumbest. And so for me, it was just like, I don't think he did it. And what is even kind of funnier to me as I look in hindsight now is I went to a lot of the players in the case because I had worked with these people. I went to the person who had prosecuted the case, Ken Anderson, and actually had a conversation with him after I read that note. And my response is, oh my God, do you think maybe you got it wrong? Do you think maybe you've got an innocent man in prison? And the response was to take me not seriously at all. And that was because, you know, people think defense lawyers kind of stereotype prosecutors. Well, prosecutors also stereotype defense lawyers. And the reaction was, oh, that's Patricia again. She thinks all of her clients are innocent. And so it's funny to look back on it now, particularly in the context of what we're discussing.
Chris, what was it like for you when you were finally were freed?
I mean, it was great. I already, being in prison, I had already came up with a game plan, what I was going to try to get out here and do. And it was so amazing that the other exonerees had already started doing it. And that was going to Austin and lobbying and letting their voice be heard about wrongful conviction. And when I did that, I always say, you know, what makes a good, great leader is a good follower. So those guys was already leading the way. And what, since it didn't make for me not to join forces with them, and once I got out and saw that was already happening and joined forces with them, I just told myself this. I said, it's more I could be doing instead of just coming to Austin and lobbying for bills and things to be passed. What about reading letters of guys just saying they was wrongful convicted, or reaching back out to some of the guys in prison that you spent all of your time with, and they're saying the same thing that you were saying. They was falsely in prison. And once I got out and I was able to find a group of men that would fight for wrongful conviction just like I would, it made my release just that much better, because this was my main focus of getting out, you know, taking on this task of trying to help free innocent men.
How have you also tried to help some of the other exonerees who have gotten out and who maybe don't have a plan like you did? One of your fellow exonerees, Billy Smith, he was identified in a show-up just like you. Mm-hmm. And he went to prison wrongly for sexual assault. And I've met with him several times for stories, and I always shake his hand. And then he finally told me, I am so scared to touch a woman and like shake a hand, or that I'll accidentally brush up against someone and I'll go to prison again. And so every time I would see him after that, I would, you know, be as nice as I could, but I never offered to shake his hand again. And one time I had to sit next to him at this event, and I was scrunching in my chair and pressing up against the guy on the other side. So I in no way like brushed up against Billy, because I'm like, he has to be so uncomfortable sitting next to me, even though, you know, we've seen each other a dozen times. And then I hadn't seen him for about a year, and it was actually at another exoneration of Stephen Brody. And remember, we had to like wait for days, like mm-hmm. we thought he was getting mm-hmm. out, and we're all outside. It was mm-hmm. a beautiful day, and I see Billy walking up, and I was just like, hey, and he just runs up and gives me the biggest bear hug I think I've ever gotten. And he had the biggest smile on his face, and he had changed so much, and he was so happy. You know, he'd gotten married and to a good woman who was very good mm-hmm. for him, and he had found his way. Mm-hmm. And it took him a long time. And for you, I think your adjustment may have been a little bit easier, but mm-hmm. how do you help these guys who get out?
I mean, basically, it's just be that support system for them. You know, they need people to talk to that's been in the same position that they've been in. So that's why it's such a brotherhood with us. When guys get exonerated, we be there for them. We be at the exoneration. And a lot of times, you know, we all give $100 bills to them. But we stop publicizing that so much because of people think we're just rolling in dough, whatever the case may be. We just know it's a struggle when you first get out of being wrongful convicted. You don't have anything. Guys that make parole have parole officers or whatever that can help them get financial, you know, satisfaction or whatever. But being an exoneree is just like you just kicked out of jail without no, you know, without anything. So we just try to be that support system for them. And I allow them to come to the store if they need some clothes and shop. You know, We also take them around, get birth certificate, driving license, social security cards. It's just about being there for, because I had Stephen Phillips there for me when I first got out. And being such an amazing man that he is, for him to take me in the way he did and give me a home to live in, pretty much gave me a car. And then not only that, put $20,000 in my bank account until I got compensated. Now you got to ask yourself, what individual go out and do that for the next person? So I was like, well, if somebody did that for me, it's my duty to do that for someone else when they get out.
Let's talk a little bit about how we avoid wrongful convictions in the future. And I know that is something that the Conviction Integrity Unit is focused on. It's not just looking at the past. It's how do we have integrity to our prosecutions today? And what do you do at the DA's office to teach not only the young prosecutors coming up, but the people who've been around a while that we need to be mindful of these wrong paths we can take?
For me, and understand I haven't been in the Dallas District Attorney's Office very long, so I don't have a long yardstick yet to measure that or answer that with. But for me, the natural starting point is I think you really have to look at the cases where somebody has been wrongfully convicted, because I think it's important to try to understand and dissect the mistakes that occurred. Because if you know that, then you know what traps you need to be looking for so that you can try to educate and train others to not fall into them. A big thing to me right now is looking at what Christopher has referred to as the tunnel vision. And I said a lot of people refer to it as cognitive bias. There's a great law review article that was written by a former prosecutor who now I understand is a law professor. And she wrote the article to look at cognitive bias in terms of how it affects prosecutors in their decision making from the very beginning of a case all the way to the end. And it's a fascinating article because she explains that the reason why she decided to research it and write it was because she had worked as a prosecutor at a time when a wrongful conviction had occurred and DNA evidence exonerated the individual and established their innocence. Yet despite that fact, many people in her own office were still maintaining that the individual had to have either committed the crime or played a role in it. And so she said it made her start scratching her head to try to figure out, how is it that people that I'm working with can look at this scenario and still maintain that position? And so she said she researched, and of course there's lots of information out there about how we look at tunnel vision and how it affects police officers. We look at tunnel vision and how it affects jurors, but we don't have a lot out there looking at prosecutors. And her point for me is well taken. It is, prosecutors are human beings just like everybody else. And she said maybe it's going to be more productive to look at that, because if we do and we understand that if cognitive bias leads to the mistakes that lead to the wrongful conviction, maybe we can figure out how to work around it, train ourselves to look at things in a different way. And in some respects, that just seems so much more productive than looking at it from a fault base, which is, I think this person did this to you because they wanted to hurt Christopher Scott, or they were bad people, or they only cared about their career.
Which is exactly how it's portrayed in Making a Murderer.
That's exactly right. And so that, to me, yes, of course, there can be some people that make decisions based on that kind of agenda, but I think probably realistically, the more often we see the mistakes, it's probably more coming from the vantage point of the tunnel vision than it is, this is a bad person who rationally made a decision to convict an innocent person.
What are prosecutors being taught today about eyewitness testimony? Because I know it used to be, and to some extent it still is, it's golden testimony. The person gets up there and says, that's him, that's the man who raped me, or robbed me, or whatever it is. And looking back at the files of Dallas County exonerations, there are instances where in a series of crimes, this is actually Stephen Phillips's case, who you mentioned earlier, the true perpetrator had blue eyes, and people talked about the piercing blue eyes, and Stephen has green eyes. And there are other similar instances where people are identified because they had on a red shirt, but they really look nothing like the actual person. How are prosecutors being taught to balance that? Because obviously we need eyewitness testimony. It's not going away, but we have to what do we do to sort of balance that out?
So I think there's multiple avenues for how you teach prosecutors to deal with that. The first one is just in a real general sense, which I have to kind of go back to what Corey Sessions said, which is just teaching the general idea that you need to look at something a little harder. You need to smell it. You need to say, if something's not right, maybe it's because something isn't right. So I think you kind of have that global viewpoint. And I think we're hearing that more and certainly teaching it more in the context of prosecutors than we did, say, 15 years ago. Separate and apart from that general category, I think you then get into the specifics, which we talked about a little while ago, which is you teach about the process and the procedure. And I certainly think there's probably been more teaching in that regard, because I think a lot of prosecutors and law enforcement offices are evolving towards better procedures for doing lineups. Then, in addition to that, I think it's also important to talk about the scientific background behind the eyewitness identification. I know Harris County, their district attorney's office, had a training recently like we did, and they actually had a speaker who was devoted to talking to that. And Jen, you mentioned some of that before, which is just, you know, we don't have a real good ability to perceive. And all of us sitting in this room right now, if somebody came in and stole my purse, as you said, we'd all probably give a different description. So I think that you got to learn about that, and you've got to learn it from the scientific point of view, so you figure out how do you deal with it when you've got a case that involves eyewitness identification.
Chris, what's your best advice to police, to prosecutors, about how to make sure what happened to you doesn't happen to somebody else?
I kind of have to piggyback on what Patricia said about, like, the first people that's at the scene of the crime. You got to get it right from right there if you want to get everything right. Because if it's not done right from the beginning, somewhere in the middle or the end, it's going to veer off because of, like I say, it all goes back to the tunnel vision syndrome. If you feel like you got the person that you think committed this crime, a lot of times they're not going to look anywhere else. But when you go look and follow the evidence, and the evidence is not saying that this guy actually committed the crime, it falls apart right there. At the very beginning, the first cop on the scene, if you get everything right then and there, it wouldn't be no room for your mistakes. But a lot of times, like I say, that tunnel vision sets in. I got Chris and Cloud. We got the two men committed this crime. We don't have to look nowhere at, even though they had the guys that fit the description, backgrounds, MOs, fit this description, they still got me and Cloud, and we hadn't been to jail for no more than traffic tickets.
Interest in wrongful convictions is possibly at an all-time high. People are really interested in it, of course, with these shows, but it's not just entertainment. These are people's lives who are being affected. Chris, what can people do to help if they're interested in this?
I mean, just basically, it's about going to the Capitol. It's about getting in touch with the people that make the bill, that make the law, that passes the law. You can email them. You can write them. It's open speaking there. You can come down as a group and just speak for a certain particular bill if you want that bill to be law. In order for us to want wrongful conviction to stop, we have to do something about it. And it's coming together.
That's all for today. Thanks for listening. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in a moment. Stay tuned to DallasNews.com for more coverage of criminal justice issues. Remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Thanks again to Christopher Scott and Patricia Cummings for coming in. Our sound engineers and producers for today are Brian Ellidge and Tommy Noel. For Sarah Mirvash and Tristan Hallman, who helped behind the scenes, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
For now, John Wiley Price is mostly a Dallas County Commissioner, trying to hold on to that $140,000 a year job. And by most accounts, he's favored to beat former Dallas City Council member Dwayne Carraway for the Democratic nomination on March 1st. But every now and then we're reminded that our man downtown also has a second track as a federal criminal defendant. The feds indicted him on 11 counts of conspiracy to commit bribery, tax evasion, and the ever-popular mail fraud. In short, he's accused of using his post on the commissioner's court to leverage illegal cash, land, and auto contributions. About 1 million all told, the feds say. A woman named Helena Tantillo was convicted last week in Austin on federal charges of lying to the FBI. What she lied about is interesting. Prosecutors say she funneled money to Price's political consultant, Kathy Neely. Neely then whacked off a chunk for Price, who then looked favorably on Tantillo's bid to make millions from Dallas County in a software contract. That's only a small slice of what the feds will trot out against Price in September if that trial date holds up. The Tantillo case was a good chance to test drive some evidence before actual jurors. Price will be tougher to crack, of course. He's also a far bigger target after all these years dispensing influence. Democrats considering a vote for him in the primary should keep that in mind.